Part 3. The Red Angel. Chapter 15. Tanis Creed's path was tiled with the crowns of 100,000 skulls, each one smoothed and polished as if it were a careworn cobblestone on the street of a fringe world. His footfalls gave off a peculiar echo in the halls of the cathedral. The density of the walls gave the sound a brittle timbre. The noise of the battle outside could barely reach them here. It was far away, a dull rumble like the breakers upon a distant shoreline. Bolt fire crackling, screams and hell shrieks resonating. It was a fitting ambience. He ran the fingers of his gauntlet over the arches and pillars rising high over his head to support the conical roof. Bunches of long femurs, surrounded by rib cages, rose up in clusters to form the shape of the pillars, each secured in place by the tiny rods of phalanges from children's hands. Jaws and spines formed porticos, butterfly hips dressed the cloister walls, and the skulls went on forever. Sightless eye sockets glared out at the legionary from above and below, some lit from within by plasmatic torchlight. The great bone temple was a magnificent creation, he reflected, a devotional work that dwarfed even the greatest monuments the word-bearers had erected to the emperor, when they had still called him master. Creed coloured at the thought of that. Lorga and his sons had laboured so long in service to the Urizen's aloof and uncaring father, and for what? They had believed so strongly in his greatness, courted the truth of his divine nature in all their acts and wars during the Great Crusade. The 17th Legion had put whole worlds to the sword for daring to defy the Emperor, and more had been set to work to build works to glorify him. Then the betrayal at Kur happened, and all eyes were finally opened. It began with the obliteration of Monarchia, that perfect tribute to the Emperor, and it ended with Monarchia, the wasteland where Lorgar was chastised for his blind love. His zealotry denied, spat upon. Tanis Creed had been there. He had seen it happen. In the aftermath, was it so surprising that the bearers of the word had realized that there was a greater truth to be born? A word not of a mortal pretending and denying his way to godhood, but of real gods, real powers, with a touch of ruin and chaos at their fingertips. Acolyte! Captain Harrocks was at his side, waiting. Creed hadn't noticed that he'd halted. He said nothing and resumed his pace, listening to the echo, feeling the build-up of silent energy in the dank air. This place, this Cathedral of the Mark, was the kind of monument they should have been creating all along. All it took was the greatest betrayal to make that clear. The lofty vaulted corridor widened, presently becoming a circular atrium, and two great curtains made of tanned human skin parted to allow Creed and Harrocks entry. One wall of the chamber was a circular mandala of thin limb bones that mimicked the frame of a chapel's devotional window, and ruddy light leaked through it, staining the yellowed shades of the uneven walls. In the middle of the floor was the entrance to a shaft that ran the height of the tower, the edges of it spiked like a maw. Skeletal arms and hands formed a ring around the sheer edge, and an unsettling azure light emanated from deep below. There was a great blood fane down there, Creed understood, a sacrificial altar like the ones on Cajor and a dozen other annexed worlds. So much pain and anguish had been poured into it that a hole had opened in the immaterium. The light was a trickle of the non-space of the warp, bleeding into this dimension, and it enticed him to come closer, to reach for it. Creed forced himself to look away. More tapestries of agony, flayed skins of different ethnicities, sewn together to make artistic forms, hung from the walls. Thick hawsers that resemble tanned leather, threaded with horsehair, were strung here and there, rising up through the mouths of skulls to suspend a glittering, indistinct shape in the ruddy gloom overhead. Creed did not glance up, however. His attention could not be drawn away from the pair of creatures that stood in the middle of the atrium, posturing and spitting at one another like a pair of fighting animals. It was a shock to see the winged, horned monster fully revealed in all its maleficent glory. What the Acolyte had only glimpsed a fraction of in its ghostly manifestation aboard the dark page was now here and real and immediate. Everything about it threatened to overwhelm him, from the brimstone stink of its body to the fuliginous aura that moved with its every step. The bloodthirster saw Creed and broke off, cocking its head to study him.
"The messenger," sneered Cabanda. "I had thought you fled."
"No," he replied, turning away for a moment to wipe an errant trickle of blood from his nostril. The same pain, the same pressure he had felt before, tightened around his thoughts. Creed resisted, pushed through, refusing to buckle, even as he saw Horrocks at his side suffering the same and faring little better. The other creature defied any description. Its soft pink body resembled human flesh of flawless silken perfection. Creed imagined it as the expression of a naked nymph-like form, pulled and twisted through a shroud of surreality until its handsome flawlessness had been corrupted by the bloom of new limbs, crustacean claws, and a monstrous head that was more horned bovine than humanoid. The rapacious gaze it laid upon him made the warrior feel somehow soiled.
"See how it shows more bravery than you, Scion of Khorne," hissed the other demon. "It did not abandon the battle after striking only one blow."
The bat-winged creature blurred and slapped the goat face with the back of its clawed hand.
"Question my resolve again, and I will send you back to Slaanesh, speared by iron."
Cabanda prodded its opposite in the chest, making it squeal in pleasure pain.
"I'll hurt you so, you won't enjoy it, Kyrus."
The other creature picked itself up and gave a demure curtsy.
"Your promises excite me, bloodthirster. I only wish we had time to explore them together."
Cabanda snorted in derision.
"Messenger, have you come to watch the end game? Above, the Void Wars fought to a standstill, and down here the tide of battle turns in upon itself."
"Sanguinius laughed at your offer of fellowship," Creed dared to say the words, regretting it instantly when Cabanda advanced angrily towards him, seizing upon the implied insult. The acolyte stood his ground. "The War Master was right. The angel is too pious, too enraptured by his father god, to ever consider going against him. His loyalty runs deeper than you could ever reach." Kyrus gave an arch snort.
"Anyone can be turned if one knows where to apply the correct pressure. Even a Primarch."
"The angel must fall and never rise,"
intoned Cabanda, repeating the words that Horus had said.
"Without him, his sons will embrace the Scarlet Path."
The demon laughed, fangs clashing.
"I have set this in motion. Sanguinius has been struck from the battlefield, and his precious legion are leaderless and enraged. They will soon give in to their baser instincts. The cry of blood for blood's sake screams in their ears."
The creature's jaws flexed in sympathetic hunger.
"Only I can understand the glorious release of bloodlust, and only Khorne can share that with them. I smell it on them, messenger. They are so very close."
Creed imagined that moment. The blood angels stripped of their sanctimonious, arrogant nobility, the armor of their auteur dirtied by mindless animal rage. A fitting degradation for the favored of the Emperor, he thought.
"They will burn in the fires of their own fury,"
growled Cabanda, relishing the thought of it.
"And it is then that they will kneel, if only for the taste of more blood."
"You make it sound so easy,"
Kyrus snapped.
"But I should expect nothing less. Your intellect is as brutish as your tactics, bloodthirster."
The gangly demon stalked around the pitmouth on spindly, sculpted legs.
"It is I who have prepared the way for this. I who marshalled the whispers of the ether and the unlocking of the sorrows of Cygnus."
Creed watched it flex its body in unnatural ways.
"This flesh I took as my vessel from the Davenite priest was remade just as I remade truth and terror and fear on these worlds."
Clawed hands clacked angrily together.
"While you sharpened your blades and looked for things to kill, It was the emissaries of Slaanesh that opened the way. Mine were the cults that arose there, not yours, warrior of corn. I planted the seeds for the witch cabals on Tarluk, Kol, and a dozen other outposts. I led their psychers to the slaughter. I answered the summons.
Kairi stamped its taloned feet on the bones beneath them.
Remember that.
The creature turned on Creed and pointed a long, thin finger at the word-bearers.
Kabanda is not master of the Cygnus Cluster. Ephemeral, no matter how loud he may beat his sword against his armour. And neither is your mortal war master. I am.
Kairis' arms all rose, as if in supplication, towards the dull light entering the chamber from an orifice at the pinnacle of the conical roof. Creed's eyes followed the gesture, compelled by the silent demands of the demon's motion.
In the name of the book, muttered Harrox, what is that?
Creed looked up, and he beheld the object that he had until now been unable to see. It had been cloaked from his vision, he realized, hidden behind some kind of glamour cast by the demon Kairis' presence. There, suspended by four of the thick skin and hair hawsers, through pulley weight mechanisms made of hip bones and cogs cut from spinal columns, a huge frame of burnished, dirty brass, sheathed in misted crystal, swayed gently to and fro. Lit by a malignant blaze within, a livid crimson mist, alike to the one that had coated Kabanda's battle axe, frothed within its confines, spilling out in coils of hissing, spitting noise. Now that he could see it, now that Kairis had revealed it to him, the word-bearer felt a wave of emotion fall from it, passing through his body like particles of radiation. The mix of potent feelings made him falter, robbing him of his balance for a moment before he could recover. Creed shook his head as the sensation passed. In a split second he had felt a powerful mélange of sensations, and the ghost of them echoed in his head like a haunting refrain from a half-heard melody. The timpani of deep, rolling agony, the carillon of heart-lost sorrow, the strident strings of despair, and louder than all, almost drowning them out, the heavy, thunderous brass of a pure and undiluted fury.
Behold the rage fire,
spat Kairis, leering at the sorcerous device.
A magic of the senses, captured and corralled, weaponized. Did you feel it, ephemeral? Even the sight of it amplifies the baser nature of those so exposed.
The demon pointed at Kabanda's huge axe.
The blow struck against the angel's warriors was so tainted by this power. The kill force of their deaths was magnified a thousandfold, enough to shock their Primarch into a fathomless sleep, where he will remain until the ruinous powers no longer wish it.
Kabanda grimaced.
Foul psi magic. It sickens me that I must be in its aura.
The fragments fell into place in Creed's thoughts. Without their master, the Blood Angels will descend deeper into their own fury. And if Sanguinius rises once, they have torn through all false veneer of their dignity.
It will break the little angel's spirit,
said Kairis, grinning hatefully. Meros looked, but he did not see. It seemed to him that he was in what had once been a corridor aboard the Red Tier, a wide passage the width of a Hive City boulevard. A great swathe of the outer hull was gone, torn away by the battle barge's headlong fall from orbit and catastrophic crash landing. And now the corridor had become a gallery open to the elements. Caustic sands and ash blown on Cygnus Prime's howling winds pooled in the lee of support stanchions. Fingers of light from the primary star and its companions threw a somber cast over everything. Meros was here, and he was not here. He felt as if a part of him was still out on the battlefield, rooted in the mud and fire, as if some fragment of his spirit was lodged there while this flesh and bone vessel had been ripped away. Each time he tried to think anew, tried to move forwards, the horror of what he had witnessed cycled back through his thoughts and tortured him as he relived it. The thought was like a raw, unhealed wound. The angel fell. He remembered the weight of his bolt pistol and his chain axe, heavy but not restrictive, powerful and ready to kill. The snarl on his lips as he stormed forwards to be in the Primarch's radiance as the battle was joined. Cassiel off in the distance, firing and culling the maddened hordes of turncoat Cygnusi. Captain Nakir, a call for war on his lips, heard over the bubbling growls of the devil dogs and screeching cries of winged furies. There, before him, Sanguinius and the Bloodthirster trading barbs and then titanic blows that cracked the earth. It would have been easy to become distracted, to behold that glorious duel to the exclusion of all else. Meros remembered cleaving the skull of a bat-winged demon, the ripe stink of the ichor that spattered from the killing wound. The fight taking him away to a place where only attacker and defender existed, when he looked up again, shaking tainted blood from the spinning teeth of the chain axe, he saw the angel strike a lethal blow upon the bloodthirster. The angel fell. Meros closed his eyes. He wanted to be wrong. He wanted to unsee what he had seen. The whip of barred brass, striking his liege lord in a moment of supreme betrayal. Sanguinius, his face contorted in pain, crashing to the ground. Meros remembered losing all sense of self-preservation, of doubt, simply breaking into a headlong charge to come to his master's aid. But then the red fire and the blinding sweep of the demon lord's axe, the cataclysm as it descended into the mass of hundreds of blood angels, all of them storming forwards with the same intent as Meros. He had been looking at Brother Gravato when the monstrous battle axe landed its blow. A bolus of incredible energy, liberated from nothingness, exploded across the ranks of the warriors. The angel fell, and my brothers perished. An inferno of hate crashed in the wake of the blow, and suddenly hundreds of legionaries were gone. Flesh and bone, adamantium and ceramite, obliterated by a power beyond reckoning. Bodies burned to cinders, armour crushed to blackened fragments, legionaries Meros had known well, erased from the face of the galaxy in a single heartbeat. And the greatest cruelty of it was the sharing of their deaths. Meros felt them all ending at once, felt it in his blood and his bones, a shock that shuddered through him and every other son of Sanguinius. If the apothecary had believed in such a thing, he might have said that it burned a hole through his soul. He fell to his knees, struggled, stumbled back into a run. All he could see was the Primarch lying in a shallow crater. The angel's wings were curled about him like a white shroud, his flesh deathly pale. Meros's heart seized in his chest. Sanguinius lived, but he was lost to them. The apothecary reached out to touch his master's face and felt the flutter of warmth. In that moment, the shard of fear that had pierced him, for it was that emotion and no other, became fire and fury. Deep in his psyche, Meros was aware of something breaking, a chain shattering, a barred door ripped from its hinges. The shock touched something primal and deadly in him, and he knew without question that every warrior who shared his bloodline was experiencing the same thing.
"Get back!"
Strong arms shoved him away, and he fell against the mud. The gold armour of the Sanguinary Guard surrounded him, gathering around their lord. Ascalon looked stricken, his eyes wild.
"Protect the Primarch!"
Meros remembered standing up, glimpsing Ralderon at the run, the first captain's warplate smeared with polluted vitae, the pale cast of astonishment on his face.
"We must fall back to the flagship," Ralderon shouted. "Regroup!"
The apothecary lurched back toward his fallen commander, forcing away all thought of what had happened, concentrating on the moment.
"I will aid him,"
he began. It was his calling. It was what he was trained to do. The angel fell, and so did I. The buzzing of a teleport beacon sounded close to his ears, but Meros paid no heed to it. He reached for the Primarch once more as emerald lightning engulfed them. And now he looked, and he saw. In the infirmary, a dozen apothecaries crowded around the comatose form of Sanguinius, trying every method to recall him to wakefulness, and failing. He had watched for a time, his body still shaking from the rematerialization trauma of the wide-sphere teleportation effect, repeating what he had seen to the stunned disbelief of the warriors who had stayed to defend the Red Tear. In a way, All of them had known the moment it happened, not just those on the battlefield, but here in the grounded flagship, and doubtless those up high in orbit, among the endless flashes of lasfire that mark the ongoing space engagement. Meros leaned forward and held on to a broken guide rail for support, as if the deck beneath him were pitching like that of a galleon in a storm. When the air deadened around him, he knew who had come.
"Did they kill him?"
asked the woman, a sob caught in her throat. He shook his head. "You should not be here, Tillian."
"How could they kill him?"
insisted Niobe, demanding an answer like a needy child. "The angel is not dead." Meros ground out the words through gritted teeth. "But he has fallen into a deathless slumber. The shock..." He faltered, unable to frame his thoughts. "I don't know how." But that was not entirely true. He suspected. At first, when word had come to him of the suicides and mental breakdowns among the crew serfs and remembrancer contingent in the fleet, Meros had considered the possibility of a disease vector as the root cause, a virus of the mind, something that left the Genhanced untouched but infected the common human. Now he wondered if the cause was non-corporeal in nature. It was no secret that the energies of warp space could ruin a man exposed to them, just as the glare of a sun would burn out eyes or radiation contaminate unprotected flesh. The stench of the warp was on these monstrosities, these demons. If they corrupted and tainted the matter of the world, as Meros had seen them do, then it would be within their power to cast a malign influence over minds unready to resist them. He remembered poor Halidice Gerwin, terrified by the sight of the immaterium, afraid to sleep for fear of what he would see in his dreams, finally driven to seek suicide in his search for peace of mind. The action of Meros's catalepsian node implant had enabled him to go without stasis sleep, since before the flotilla had arrived in the Cygnus cluster. If I embraced sleep now, he wondered, what would I see? And a far greater question loomed larger. What if the Legiones Astartes are not immune to such powers?
"He's trapped," Niobe was saying, "and without Sanguinius we will all die here."
The woman's words lit a sudden towering anger in Meros' chest, and he rounded on her with enough speed to make her cry out in fear.
"Be silent!" he roared, his collar turning to rage out of nothing. "Get below and stay there. Now! Now!"
In that moment, all he wanted to do was swat her aside, crush her fragile meat into pulp against the broken bulkheads. Niobe fled, and Meros' surge of fury ebbed with her, dissipating as quickly as it had come. He grimaced and took in a long breath, reaching deep inside to quieten himself. He did not succeed. The battle was spiraling toward madness. Brother Sergeant Cassiel dropped into cover behind a grounded speeder. The contra-gravity flyer had been swatted from the sky by a hybridized horror that merged the characteristics of a gigantic hornet and a battery of scimitars. The crew died in the impact, but Cassiel's squad had avenged their deaths with plasma fire and a cascade of frag grenades. For all the sheer, sickening presence of these so-called demons, they could still die if you poured enough fire into them. This single grim fact was all the veteran had to hold on to. Everything else was crumbling around him, coming apart like wet sand. The din of blind guns and the crash of claws and blades came from all sides. Unit cohesion was gone. Communications from squad to squad were a mess of overlapping channels and broken protocols. And then, only when the Vox could actually be coaxed into working. In the past hour, Cassiel had received a dozen conflicting orders, some from the same voices only moments apart. His company commander, Captain Furio, had ordered an advance and then a retreat, on both occasions missing out vital code phrases to authenticate his directives. It was either a ruse or a failure of will. Either option was unthinkable. Thick smoke that ran black and crimson engulfed the battle zone, cutting visibility down to almost nothing. And yet at odd moments, the clouds would part as if they were part of a staged performance, if only to show the legionaries the towers of the great Temple of Bones looming large in the distance. The inertial mag compass display in Cassiel's helmet was constantly shifting, making it hard to find a heading. In annoyance, he had torn it off and thrust it into the hands of Cade, the tech marine, demanding he repair it. Cade insisted the helm was working perfectly. Latio dared to peer over their cover and snipe off a trio of rounds at a black dog beast that came towards them, barking and snarling. It died in a mess of innards, and Cassiel swore that he could see a twinkling mist dissipate from its cooling corpse. The sergeant rested against the speeder wreck, his heavy backpack pressed to the steaming metal. He checked his ammunition and scowled. It was enough for now, but he had no idea of how long it would be before resupply. Cassiel considered picking up a weapon dropped by one of the cannon fodder zealots, but the gun was for human hands and would be like a toy to a legionary. That, and the fact that the grip was coated in some kind of perfumed slime that seemed to exude from the weapon itself. He glanced around at the dozen or so other blood angels who held their places around the wreckage. All were sullen and withdrawn, offering nothing. A cold, steady drumbeat of dread was working its way through Cassiel's thoughts, and he could not stem it. He had seen the great winged creature, the Bloodthirster, sweep across the face of the suns as it passed over them, diving back toward the Bone Cathedral. The shadow it cast was not just the absence of light, but an eclipse of sense and reason. In the moment he had fallen under its darkness, the veteran had never felt so alone, so isolated from his battle brothers. For a legionary, it was a little death with a horror all of its own. Under it all, the echo of the shock had not faded. Cassiel had not spoken of it to Cade or Latio, at first because they were knee-deep in killers, but later because he had no words to express it. The sergeant didn't need to ask if they had felt it too. One look into their eyes, and he saw the mirror of his own hollow gaze. A great, baleful firestorm had burned briefly away in the heart of the fighting, and Cassiel had heard death screams in the singing of the blood in his ears. He did not know what it meant. Footsteps drew them all to their guns as a battered youth in scout armor staggered out of the smog and into the midst of the group. His gun was clogged with blood and viscera where it had been used like a club, and there were deep claw cuts across his face and neck, wounds that did not seem to be clotting. The scout bore the sigil of the 72nd Company, barely visible through the impact dents on his chest plate.
"Oh, brother," said Latio, "where is your squad?"
The scout ignored the question.
"He's dead," said the youth. "It killed him. I saw it."
"Who?"
Cade asked, but Cassiel's throat tightened. He instinctively knew what the youth meant.
"No,"
snapped the sergeant. The shadow was falling over him again. "No, the angel lives. He cannot be killed." Cassiel grabbed the scout by the gorget and pulled him off balance.
"You are mistaken,"
he bellowed.
"Say it."
"No,"
came the reply. The scout offered no resistance, and that made Cassiel's fury burn even hotter. In that moment he felt his control slip away, and he readied his fist to strike the youth with a blow that would crush his skull.
"No,"
he repeated.
"Stay your hand."
The command was a rough shout, and a figure in black came forward through the mist brandishing the sparking rod of Acrosius. Legionaries stood back as he approached, and Warden and Ellis's scowling helm surveyed them all with grim intent. Cassiel released his grip, but his fists went tight with unspent hatred.
"Hold, brothers," Anellis insisted, casting around. "Our master lives. I know this for fact." "How can you?" demanded Cade. "The Vox is contaminated by enemy signals and subterfuge. There has been no word." "I know here."
The warden slammed his fist against his chest.
"You all felt the..."
He paused, struggling to find the word.
"The darkness pass, didn't you? And even now, the echo of it claws in our minds."
Cassiel nodded. He couldn't deny it. There was a malaise out here, working on all of them, silent and unseen, stoking their rage with every passing moment.
"We have to get away from this place," muttered the scout.
"No,"
said Anellis, removing his helmet so he could look them in the eyes.
"There is nowhere we can go that this will not touch us. If we falter or lose focus, the enemy will use it against us."
His eyes flashed,
so pity their mistake, my brothers. They took the worlds of weakened men by coward subterfuge. They fail to understand that now it is the Ninth Legion they face instead.
The warden raised the Crozius.
They seek to enrage us? They have done so. But it will be these monsters that pay the price for daring to unchain our hate.
A roar of approval erupted from Cassiel's lips, and the echo of it came from all the legionaries about him. It served to mask the doubts, for the moment at least. The wind moaned through the shattered armor glass of the command deck's portals, carrying with it the skirl of gunfire and other less identifiable sounds from the distant battle. Captain Raldron held the wireless vox auger to his ear, listening to the device as it scanned back and forth across the tactical communications channels, struggling to find something to lock onto. Every signal was the same, a wash of bubbling static that at first seemed random, but after a moment's scrutiny became a pattern like mocking laughter or atonal hymns. Raldron's patience snapped as he spun about, hurling the device across the bridge with such force that it exploded into fragments against the far bulkhead. The mute servitors working at makeshift repairs to the command consoles paid no heed to the captain's moment of unexpected fury, but there was no mistaking the judgment in the eyes of Ascalon, who had chosen that moment to enter the chamber. The first captain glared at the guard commander, daring him to make comment, but Ascalon seemed only weary. The expression seemed out of place on the warrior's hawkish face, and it told Raldron all he needed to know about the Primarch's current state.
"The Legion is in disarray," he said after a moment. "The battle in orbit fares little better than the melee on the wastes. Signals are erratic and garbled. Entire companies are out of contact or else ignoring direct orders to disengage and fall back."
"I cannot blame them," Ascalon said quietly.
Raldoron's eyes narrowed.
"This is not who we are. There are reports of legionaries killing everything in their path, fighting without heed or direction. It is wrong. The Blood Angels are not Russ's dogs or Angron's feral savages."
"No," said the sanguinary guard, his hard tone returning.
"We are worse than them, for we hide it beneath our noble guise. We keep our fury chained. Small wonder, then, that it burns brighter when finally given release."
The captain strode angrily across the command deck, shaking his head.
"You excuse this?"
He jabbed his finger toward the broken windows and the wasteland beyond.
"The enemy wounds us, and so we lose control in a heartbeat? I say no."
He drew close to Ascalon, his words rising into a shout, his fists clenching.
"Is that the Angel's way, brother? Is that what he would want from his sons?"
"Look to yourself," he shot back. "We all feel the wrath, every son without question."
Raldoron's rising anger robbed him of words, and he turned away with a hissing snarl. The captain smacked his armored fist into his palm, grinding ceramite against ceramite. Ascalon fixed him with his cold, steely gaze.
"We must decide now how we shall proceed, you and I. With Lord Sanguinius laid low and the Council of Angels scattered, it falls to us to take joint command of the Legion."
The first captain was stopped dead by the guard commander's statement. He was right, of course, but still it felt like disloyalty to say it aloud.
"Very well," he said, biting out the reply. "The Primarch is the Legion is the Primarch," said Ascalon, repeating the words that were laser etched in high Gothic about the neck ring of his golden armor. "His life must be preserved over all else. We must remove him from the malign influence of this foul place, fight our way free of the Cygnus Cluster."
"You want to run?"
Raldron could not keep a sneer from his words.
"This ship cannot lift. The tech marines in the engine halls have only just managed to place the reactor core in quietus. You would have us leave the flagship behind for the enemy to pick clean? Evacuate the Primarch to another vessel," Ascalon went on. "Unshackle the core. The Red Tear's death was not prevented, only postponed."
"And what of the legionaries left behind?" snarled Raldoron.
"There are not enough auxiliary craft to take them all, even if we could pull them back here."
He prodded the guard commander in the chest.
"You callous bastard! You would sacrifice our own?"
Ascalon met his anger with cold defiance. There is much I would do for the life of Sanguinius. I deem you, or I, or any brother who wears the crimson, expendable, if it means the angel lives on. And I defy you to find me one warrior among the Legion who would not willingly cut their own throat to save him. I won't allow it. Without conscious thought, the first captain's hand fell to the brass hilt of the power sword at his hip. That choice has never belonged to any of us. Raldoron shook his head, anger building anew. The angel gave his orders. It is our duty to fulfill them or to die in the attempt. Cygnus must be purged. His will be done. The sword sang as a measure of its length emerged from its sheath, and by reflex Ascalon reached up to draw the glaive in carmine from his back scabbard. The two warriors froze, their raw fury straining for liberation, blades singing as they drifted toward deadly release. Raldoron experienced a flash of black, abysmal dread, and he unclenched his hand, letting the sword drop back into place. Ascalon warily did the same, and they stood glaring at one another, slowly reeling in their ire. At length the guard commander spoke. Whatever sorcery happened out there, whatever arcane power has been employed, it has touched us all, those proximate and those not. A fire has been kindled, Raldoron. It may consume us. How? He asked. How could they know? Neither of them needed to speak of the floor. Both had been there on the day long ago that Sanguinius had brought them to secret council, where he had revealed the sorrow that haunted him, the dark potentiality of a red thirst buried in each and every one of them, now dragged to the surface by what? Magic? And witchcraft? If we cannot escape this place, we will succumb. Ascalon frowned. Look at us, brother. Fury is eating at us from within. It is only a matter of time before we become no better than the berserkers we dispatched in battle. We will fall into the company of death. Raldoron closed his eyes and saw armour painted over with ink black. When he opened them again, a third figure was standing at the broken hatchway, clad in heavy robes. Before either of them could speak, he reached up and pulled back the hood over his head. First Captain, Guard Commander, I would speak. You are Carno, the once Psyker. Ascalon gave him a grave look. How long have you been listening to our words? Long enough. What do you want? Snapped Raldoron, distrust evident in his eyes. This is no time for distractions. A number of my brothers have gathered, said Carno. He saw the two warriors share a look, both of them immediately understanding that he meant more by that word than just his fellow blood angels. Some from the battle, some down from orbit. Ascalon eyed him. You summoned them? Carno shook his head. We came because we knew we were needed. Too late, Raldoron said bitterly. No, said Carno. Not yet. He looked from one warrior to the other. Ascalon speaks the truth. A shadow falls across every legionary whose heart is Blood Angel, and that darkness has a source. I have seen it. By which sight? The captain challenged him to answer. Does it matter, Lord? Before Raldoron could reply, he pushed on. Carno put aside all doubts in his mind, concentrating on what he knew to be true, what he believed was right. Nothing else mattered now. Carno knew that with cold clarity. If there was such a thing as fate, then his would turn on the next words he spoke. The Temple of Bones holds the heart of the demon's power in this world. If it can be found, it can be destroyed. The Legion will be freed from its own fury. The first captain glanced towards the ruined oval portal. A battleground of madness lies between us and that objective. An army of monsters from the soul of all nightmares, and our brothers caught upon it. It would be a crossing through hell, aye, said Carno. Ascalon studied him coldly. And what of the angel? What have you seen for him? I can revive him. Carno said the words aloud for the first time, and he knew in his heart that it was no vain hope, no idle boast. We can revive him. The Psykers. Raldoron was grim-faced.
If Sanguinius was felled by the power of the warp, then by the same he could awaken.
Carno nodded, fully aware of the door he was about to open, not just for himself, but his entire legion.
These demons are the spawn of the Immaterium, and only by like powers can their influence be broken.
That's not all that will be broken, grated Ascalon. What of the Nicaea Edict, the command of the Emperor of Mankind? Are we to go against him and the rule of terror? It will make us traitors.
Ralderon turned a solemn gaze upon his comrade.
Then so be it.